Hello, this is Sadie Scotch, the host of the Scotch with Sadie podcast. This is the podcast where we drink scotch and learn about business strategies. Let's meet my special guest now. Hi, Kesha. Thank you for joining us today on Scotch with Sadie. I see that you are in San Francisco, California. How has your day been? What's your week like? What's going on?
Well, it's been fantastic. We've been working hard on getting the product right. We've got lots of customers using it, and we're very product-centric. The response to most of the things that customers want is to build better product. So we've been quite busy building a great product.
Excellent. Now, before we get too much into the product, because Kashyap Diora is, of course, the CEO and founder of HyperTrack, which helps many different kinds of companies build live location tracking into their apps and solutions. So we're going to get into that. But of course, as usual, to kick this off, we're going to start the conversation around scotch to smooth things over. So today I am drinking a Macallan 12 years old, double cast. It was cast in both European and American oak cases. My boss, the CEO of Responsify, gave me this for our Secret Santa exchange. I think he was trying to tell me to record more podcasts, but that is what I am drinking. Kashyap, what are you drinking today?
I'm drinking a Glenlivet 12. Okay. And that's the bottle that was at our office. I love scotch, and single malt, any sort of single malt is, works well for me. We were at this, a team session with one of the board members who was buying us beer, and soon the beer segued into scotch, and everybody had a different preference of which scotch they liked, but we were universal in our love for scotch as a team, and it emerged that the Glenlivet is the one that between the team, all of us like, you know, the most. So as a team, that's what we drink. And that was the bottle at my office before I started this podcast.
Excellent. Now I know the answer to what is HyperTrack's favorite scotch. That's right. But I have one question for you around scotch whiskey to see if you're a real connoisseur. So I was searching the internet for these questions, but what is the minimum number of years a Scotch whiskey must be aged in oak barrels for?
Wow.
I can give you three options, either 3, 6, or 12.
I want to say 3.
You got it.
Oh, cool.
3 is the right answer. I checked many different websites and that was the one that came up. It's the answer is 3.
Everybody wants a big market for what they're selling.
Yes, right. Exactly. Okay. So now that the fun part of talking about scotch is over, but we get to keep drinking the scotch as we speak, we're going to move into more important topics, namely, you know, your baby, your business. So according to your website, HyperTrack is a creation economy company. You help other companies build systems to track their commerce. So to start, what impact do you have on the creation economy? And actually, what is the creation economy? We'll start there.
Sure. You know, the old saying of when you're in a gold rush, sell shovels, sell jeans, instead of being a gold miner. I think what's happening is, look, software is eating the world, and there are more and more software developers and product builders who are building automation, building experiences with software. And their imagination is only limited by the tools available. And the whole API economy of companies like Stripe or Twilio or Algolia is to give these product builders better tools and better building blocks to make their imagination come to life. So the whole economy of helping product builders fulfill their imagination in a certain area using better tools and better infrastructure is the creation economy.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then where does HyperTrack fit into that?
So in particular, we saw that lots of companies, lots of businesses, and product managers and engineering teams within those companies want to build great live location experiences. They experience products like Uber and WhatsApp and Google Maps to share live location with each other. You know, it's in the palm of their hands every day in their sort of day-to-day experience. And then they go, well, why can't I have this same power for making my business better and my product experience better? And then they sort of realize that even simple live location features are really hard to build and manage. And that's where HyperTrack comes in, saying, look, just focus on building what you want. You want a great tracking experience for your customers, or you want your teams to be able to sort of track their work when they're out there. You should be able to get far without having to build and operate complex infrastructure. So with HyperTrack, you can build stuff within minutes or within hours, which would otherwise take you weeks and months.
Okay. And you've mentioned developers and engineers a few times in, you know, your last answer. So the first time we spoke over the phone, you also mentioned that you learned a lot about how to market to different roles within an organization, that marketing to developers is a lot different than marketing, say, like consumer marketing, and that you've learned some things that about how best to go about marketing to these types of people and to different types of organizations. So can you tell us a bit more about that and what you've learned about marketing to developers in particular?
Got it. Well, so when you're selling to businesses, which HyperTrack is, similarly, which, you know, Stripe or Twilio and Algolia are, the typical way we imagine that sale to be is, you know, you talk to someone at the organization, then decision makers get involved, you tell them what's possible, you get some sort of contract going with them, and then, you know, integration begins, and then you sort of take the product live. But what happens with developers is they do not like being sold to, and they do not like being marketed to. Developers do not meet salespeople or marketing people. You know, they go to conferences, but, you know, to sort of learn rather than to be sold. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would sort of generalize that to not just the engineers who write in code, but engineering managers, product managers, the whole product builder side of the organization is they're not the buyers, they are the builders. And at the same time, you know, we're selling to those builders. And if we take an approach where we're selling to them, you know, it's going to be a hard journey because they're not buying. So the way to sort of get these tools out to developers is to sort of be where they are, meet them where they are. You need to be found by them rather than, you know, selling to them, if that makes sense. And in that sense, it's more similar to sort of consumer marketing, where you find ways to let consumers find you. So look at these developers as consumers who are sitting inside of these companies, who are, you know, getting their news on Hacker News or getting the next big product on a product hunt, or going to GitHub to sort of find open source repositories, or going to Stack Overflow to answer specific questions, going to Reddit to sort of consume news as well. So you need to be found where they are, and write content which, you know, which they're looking for, and that's sort of how you get to the developers. And once you've found, developers love to tinker and to play around with Lego blocks. If you're an API, they'd want to sort of test it out, use it, you know, see the green light come up. So giving them quick gratification and sort of very quick time to value, so that once they find you, you are able to show them the wow factor as quickly as possible. And once again, that's more like consumers, where once they find your app, they're either going to use you for a long period of time or just abandon you 10 seconds later. So
right.
The first impression is very important, and getting them the gratification or the belief within a very quick time is instrumental to success.
Great. Well, you're speaking the Responsify language right now. We are an inbound marketing agency. So we definitely believe in the power of not over preaching to consumers, or like you kind of described, these product managers and developers, they're consumers within an organization. And so I'm wondering, you know, did that take you and your team a while to figure out that this kind of content marketing approach was the right fit for your industry? Was that an evolution of trial and error? How did you guys experience like figuring out the right marketing mix for your company?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I think that's where the world is sort of moving to across the board, not just in the developer tools and API economy or the creation economy. And I think the way it's happening is the attention spans are reducing. You know, you've got people with lower attention spans, a lot of different things competing for their time, and it's increasingly becoming harder to prioritize what you should do. And so being able to hold attention of a bunch of people sitting in a room, first of all, getting them in a room, and then sort of pitching to them and having them hold attention for an hour, you know, gone are the days. And I'm sort of hearing more of that in enterprise software as well. So I'm seeing in general sales and marketing moving more towards learn as you do, get found rather than, more pull than push. Make incremental sort of changes. So you go one step at a time. You can build sort of big things or get to sort of a big sale, but you have to start small and iterate. So I would say, you know, that's where things are going in general. And in particular, I think the beauty or the curse of the creation economy is that, developers are hard to bullshit to, if I can use that word on the podcast. So they see through it and get to the truth very, very quickly. So that keeps you honest at a sort of different level. You know, you can't fake it if you've released the product too soon or the product doesn't hold up. They're going to know that very quickly. And then many other people will know that very quickly as well. I think we learned it the hard way as well, building the right product and evangelizing that through the right content is very important. And the quality benchmark is relatively higher in the creation economy because these guys and girls are building real stuff, and they see the truth very, very quickly.
Yeah. Great. Well, you know, transitioning the conversation from different types of roles within an organization to marketing to different regions, different cultures with different business behaviors. I know that you guys also, you have locations around the globe. You have offices in Ukraine and India and in the US, and in any case, you're selling across different regions. So what lessons learned, you know, what takeaways do you have to share about marketing to different regions, North America versus India and South Asia, for example? What you just said about content marketing and the pull versus the push, does that hold up internationally as well in your experience?
Sure. Yeah, you know, I would say across the board, across industries, the world is, you know, the business is becoming far more global. I see more American companies go global quicker, you know, earlier in their life cycle, and have a more fragmented global footprint compared to, let's say, 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And so in general, that's the trend. Now, imagine that you have to, support a global footprint through local salespeople and local support people. There are structural limitations to how global you can be. In a creation economy company, those constraints do not exist. You put your software up on the internet, you put your Lego blocks up online, developers find you where they are, and where they are is the internet. They're not at any one geographical place. So it's really a great leveler for where the market really exists. And you discover that very quickly. You could post something on a Hacker News and go trending, and you'll find how far and wide that message spreads and where the consumers of that content are. And what we observed very quickly with HyperTrack was our global footprint was very wide very soon. And we thought, you know, are we doing something wrong? Are we doing something right? What's happening here? This is not similar to any of the companies I've worked with before. And with my colleagues as well, you know, they had a similar sort of experience. And we realized that, you know, developers are everywhere. The market is now everywhere. It's far more wide. It's just that you do not have the constraints of geography when you're selling something on the internet, which works for everybody right off the bat. So you find that in reality, you know, the world's really become size small, and, you know, or the world's become fat, whichever metaphor you prefer. And that reflects very quickly in a API kind of company. Mm-hmm.
And was this because you were getting inbound leads from, in, you know, companies based internationally? Were they coming to you? How did you go global so quickly?
Absolutely. So, you know, if your playbook is you publish content, you open source sample apps, you put your product out on the internet, and the only way you're selling is developers finding you and then sort of tinkering around with your platform and then going to production and swiping their card, we discover our market while we're asleep. You know, we wake up and see, oh, here's a new ping on this side of the world. And hey, what's all this activity happening with this company? I wonder what they do. And then you realize, oh, this is the largest grocery delivery company of Southeast Asia, for example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the sort of beauty of this world is the world of creation economy is, you know, people find you and then you're sort of discovering where the market exists and doubling down on the trends that you observe and sort of do that iteratively. And our observation seems consistent with other companies in the creation economy as well, where their global footprint by default happens to be more fragmented than a traditional B2B company, because truly we're in a world where, the world is flat.
Great. Well, then going from, you know, your market and your clients that are international, I'd like to now focus in on your company, on HyperTrack itself, which I read on your website is also very international. Again, global office locations, but also under the About section, it mentions that you guys collectively speak 10 languages amongst everybody. So how has you know, this international aspect of your company affected just your workforce, how you all work together, how the company operates, pros and cons? You tell me.
Got it. We need to update our website. It's 12 languages now.
12.
yeah, it's phenomenal. You know, even in the San Francisco office, we've got a fairly diverse, I guess, ethnicity, religion, languages, and, you know, where we sort of grew up geographically. And I think what that brings in is a certain diversity of perspective, which can be a double-edged sword. We've done things to make it a strong positive, you know, there are things that you can do to make that a compelling advantage, as opposed to being neutral about it. You know, it really helps to have different time zones represented, where we can support our customers. You know, while Ukraine is asleep, we're awake. While we're asleep, Ukraine is awake. We've got lots of customers in India because India has seen tremendous growth in the last few years. And our usage growth in India is phenomenal. So having people who can sort of show up or speak the same language or be in the same city invokes a lot of trust in, you know, when customers are betting their production applications on HyperTrack. And sort of culturally in our conversations, it automatically makes us be better listeners. You know, if you have a homogeneous culture and you all naturally align and think the same way and look in the same direction, you can often reject ideas which are not consistent with that consensus. But in a diverse group, you sort of program yourselves to be better listeners, to get work done every day, and that ends up being a great advantage as long as you can figure out how you resolve conflict and how you come out strong on the same page and not leave important things unresolved or hanging.
Okay, great. Now, I also want to ask, you know, about some of the hiccups that you faced in a fast-growing startup, and I'd also like to know specifically if it has anything to do with the creation economy still being defined. But of course, you know, you've had a lot of wins since HyperTrack's inception in 2015, I believe it was, investment rounds. So I'm just wondering, you know, what challenges that maybe are specific to the creation economy, maybe we're more specific to your company. You know, what challenges did you face at different stages of your growth? Which ones were unexpected? You know, you were the least prepared for them. And which challenges taught you the most in your growth?
Sure. Yeah, you know, this is actually a great question and a lot of themes come to mind. But the one I would focus on is, you know, it's increasingly becoming, you know, sort of hip to say that, well, remote working is our strength and, you know, remote is the way to go. And especially in the developer tools world, you have some great successes with companies that have been built remote first. And I actually have a sort of contrary view to that. You know, remote has worked really badly for us. And what we find is sort of making, you know, building a great product and making sort of day-to-day decisions with tremendous amount of fast-changing context is best done in the same room with face-to-face conversation, with a whiteboard, with sort of feeling the emotion of the other person. And, you know, building developer products is no exception to that rule. So I would say in the history of Hypercrack, you know, if we've made some missteps or lost time, it's primarily because of the collective desire of global talent to be remote. And we sort of said, hey, look, that's where the world is moving to. A lot of people are making that work. I'm sure we can too. And we were consistently unable to do so. We have relied on teams in the same room with strong leadership, a strong sense of team, and a culture that binds us together, you know, the old school stuff. We have relied on that for success. And wherever we overdid the remote thing, you know, and went too process-oriented or too written communication-oriented or too contract-oriented, which you sort of have to be with the remote team, the ability to deal with change drastically reduces. And that was our experience at Hypercrack is, you know, this whole remote thing does not work.
Okay. Now that's a really interesting perspective. it's almost like, you know, all these, any trends that kind of happen in business or otherwise, there's usually a reversal. So like you said, it's become very popular to work remote and just, yeah, people think that that is the future, but maybe there'll be a swing to closer communication, across different businesses. So I just have a few more questions. I want to, you know, give you the
interrupt you, Sadie. I'm sorry, but you know, I think there's a selection bias also that we suffer from. There are a bunch of companies who achieve product market fit very quickly, who are lucky enough to get the product right at first pass, usually because of the collective efforts of a few people in the same room, I believe. And then, you know, post-product market fit, remote can become a strength. You know, formal contracts and clear written communication can be an amplifier. But for every success story that we hear where potentially product market fit happened very quickly and then scale was enabled by remote, what we're missing is hundreds or maybe thousands of companies which are going straight to the graveyard because of trying to make remote work at an early stage, but who failed to a large extent because of trying to build a product remotely too soon.
Okay, great. Thank you for that clarification. I was going to ask just one of my final few questions to kind of open the floor and ask you what's next for Hypercrack. Where do you see yourself, typical question, but in 2-5 years and yeah, what impact do you think Hypercrack could have in the creation economy again?
Sure. You know, I would say any business that has things on the move, people, deliveries, you know, any business that has things on the move wants to use the live location of those assets to build a better business, to build better product experience, to build more efficiencies. And that sort of inevitable trend is reinforced every day when we use ride-sharing apps or consumer apps with location sharing in it. And we go, you know, if I can track my $5 ride, I have all of this, this part of my enterprise or this part of my business on the move. I should be able to use that data to build a better business. And the goal of Hypercrack is to get more and more of these product builders to fulfill their imagination and to build anything they can imagine with live location, really in the context of business. In particular, we're staying away from tracking consumers because we believe that that violates their privacy and consumers do not expect to be tracked. But when you're working and there are business assets on the move, you know, the company sort of tracks them to automate and to make the workforce more productive. That's the space we're focused on. Our goal would be to see more and more use cases get built with HyperTrack, which we have not imagined ourselves. Right? So we get a lot of pleasure from companies popping up who start using HyperTrack, and then after a few months, we figure out what they built with it. And we think, wow, this is phenomenal. We never thought something like this would happen with HyperTrack. So more and more applications being built in ways that we have not imagined would be very gratifying for us.
Great. And on that note, a positive outlook to the future, I just wanted to end with a quote from a very wise philosopher. And actually, that's you, Cash App. I read this on the internet. The quote is, "Location isn't a point, it's a line. Location is at the heart of modern commerce." So, you know, Cash App or Confucius, same thing. Just wanted to end with that. So how can people learn more about HyperTrack? How can they get in contact with you if they're interested in learning more?
Sure. You know, thank you for that. Go to HyperTrack.com, sign up for an account, and start playing around with the API. It'll be fascinating to see the kind of data that we can generate for you, the real-timeness of that data, the accuracy of that data. And the beauty of the platform is that location-based services were restricted to the boundaries of a device. You can do a lot of things on the device whose location you're tracking to make the experience better. But a lot of applications need to be built where the location of the devices being available to you in the cloud sort of unlock a whole world of possibilities. And that jump is just harder than it needs to be. You know, the operating system will give you locations back on the device, but not in the cloud. And the maps guys say, come to me with location. I'm not here to manage your location for you. So the whole power of having live location data of your assets in the cloud unlocks a whole world of applications, and you will experience that very quickly when you sign up with HyperTrack. That's the way to try it out. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Cash App. Have you finished all of your scotch?
Not yet, but I'm
not yet. Well, maybe since it's, what time is it in San Francisco? 5:30. You can go out and enjoy the rest. Us here in New York City, it's getting late, so I bid you adieu. And thank you so much for sharing your story and the story of the creation economy and where you fit into that.
Sounds great. Hey, it's the city that never sleeps, so you should go out and party now.
So I should just hit the streets right now.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity, Sid.
This has been another edition of Scotch with Sadie, presented by Responsify. Thanks again to my special guests, where we learned a bit about their story and, of course, a bit about Scotch. To find out about future episodes, you can visit responsify.com/Scotch with Sadie. And to learn more about Responsify and how we help companies grow, you can visit responsify.com or email me directly at sadie@responsify.com. Or follow me on LinkedIn at Sadie Scotch. Until next time, cheers to growth.